The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, Black students in America are more likely to be disciplined with out-of-school suspension than their white counterparts. Author Aaron Kupchak explores the legacy of racism and segregation in schools. And we'll cheer on a robotics competition in Massachusetts. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Black students in America are more likely to be disciplined with out-of-school suspension than their white counterparts. The suspension gap is the subject of a new book by our guest, Aaron Kupchak. Kupchak, a professor of sociology and criminal justice at the University of Delaware, explores the legacy of racial injustice in his book, Suspended Education, published by New York University Press. Kupchak's book seeks to understand and argues against the use of exclusionary punishments in schools. I spoke with him to learn more.
When I started my career, I was first interested in how we police and punish young people. And initially, my interest was in how we prosecute kids as adults when we transfer them to adult court. But, you know, I realized that, thankfully, relatively few children make it into the court system. But they almost all go to schools. And if we're interested in studying how we police and punish children, how we socialize them into rules of society and punishment systems, that schools are really the important place to be looking. And so for many years now, I've been looking at school policing and school punishment in particular. And that journey has been great and it's been interesting. But over the last several years, I've realized that a lot of people were studying and had great insights into how we punish children and things like racial disparity in punishment and so on. But nobody had gone back and said, why do we suspend children to begin with? This practice that produces only negative outcomes for the most part, meaning it doesn't help students' behavior while leading to all sorts of negative consequences for the student as well as their families and even their schools. So that's really what led to this particular project, is trying to answer that by looking back historically at how this came to be.
Sure. And you write in the book about the discovery of suspension or rediscovery of school suspension after schools were desegregated. And you dive a lot into the legal history there. But why did you choose to use this word discovery of school suspension?
It's a good question, in part because it's, you know, I think that it's captivating. But in some sense, it's not very accurate, because it's not as if nobody suspended kids before Brown versus Board of Education. It was just used much less commonly. And so I use it more figuratively to say, well, when did this come to be the solution of choice? When did this come to be the modal way of responding to problematic students or disruptions? So it's, you know, in some sense, it's, you know, I don't intend to say that no child was ever suspended before 1954, when Brown versus Board of Education came about. But it just wasn't discussed. It wasn't written up in, for example, superintendent's reports that I found. It wasn't a real feature of what schools did until we saw actual desegregation and black students entering formerly all-white schools and schools using suspension as a way to get them out.
What did you find are the motivating factors behind the educators who do suspend students?
Well, when we're talking about current day educators suspending students, it's typically because they have a problem. It's a real problem, and they don't have any good options. You know, I really have a lot of empathy for teachers, and I think that at first glance, I think my arguments that are very critical of what we do in schools could be seen as anti-educator, and that's not at all how I feel or the way I've tried to write this book. I think that teachers, you know, they tend to do a really difficult job for insufficient pay, we don't support them enough, and we tend to blame them for pretty much everything that goes wrong in society. And that's not fair. And I don't intend to pile on with that. Instead, I feel for them. Teachers today often face too large of classes with students who might not be sufficiently prepared and come to class with all sorts of issues that get taken out in their behavior. The problem isn't that the teacher needs to, the problem isn't with the teacher. The problem is that the teacher doesn't have the right supports. The problem is that the teacher doesn't have the right policies in place, or they're not put in place for the teacher to do something more productive. So if I'm teaching to 35 or 40 students and one is making that very difficult and I have to get through my lesson plan, I might have no option but to send that kid to the principal, who then sends that child home for 3 days. A much better strategy would be to have support staff on site who have a rapport with children, who have a background in adolescent development, who can get to the roots of why this child is acting up and try to solve the problems. So it's a real response, a practical response to real issues. The problem is that by making that the only option, we don't solve the problems at hand and we create more problems.
So you point out with examples of how Black students are disproportionately suspended compared with their white counterparts, and you open the book with a story about a student named Marcus. Could you tell me about Marcus's story and why you chose to use that as an example in the opening pages of the book?
Sure. So I think the context of that story, of when I heard about that story, matters. I had been giving a presentation, running a panel for local educators about implicit bias, implicit racial bias, and school punishment. And one of the educators, who was a principal at a local school, local high school, got pretty defensive and interrupted and said, "Hey, his actual phrase was, it's not as if we walk around with pitchforks looking for Black students to punish." And we talked about implicit racial bias and how that's no one's accusation that he has a pitchfork, that it doesn't have to be intentional, and what it actually means. And I think it was a productive conversation. And at the end, I was chatting with a woman whose classroom I was using. She's a Black female educator, and she was talking about her son, who I gave the pseudonym to Marcus to in the book. And she told me about how Marcus was a student in that principal's school, the one who was defensive. And one day during math class, Marcus stood up. He was doing his work with a pencil, and he stood up to sharpen his pencil, as he was, of course, allowed to do. His teacher was taken aback. She was standing near him. He stood up. She perceived that as threatening and aggressive. He's a tall Black male in high school. And she sent him to the office, and that principal then suspended him. So I use that as an illustration of how we do this in ways that don't really make sense and that come from a defensive posture, because we're sometimes not paying attention to what students are actually doing or listening.
In the book, you talk about the structural racism that is within the school system and the legacy. We had mentioned Brown versus the Board of Education and desegregation, and the legacy of desegregation. Could you tell me a little bit about that research and what you believe the effects of desegregation were years later within the school system, within the institution of the school environment?
Absolutely. This is a topic that obviously upsets a lot of people, that can be contentious. And I think there's so much misunderstanding. It's not a topic that's supposed to make people feel bad for mistakes that have been made decades ago by other people. But if we want to do better for children today, we need to understand the past and how that past has resulted in a set of practices that we have today, so we can do better. With that in mind, so I do talk a lot about structural racism and the history of structural racism and how it influences the present, as you asked about. And what we find is that what many scholars have written about and shown conclusively is that the inequality of the past, starting going back to days of slavery, where young Black people or any Black people weren't allowed to learn to read and write. Then after emancipation, the inequality in access to education was immense. Even once there were schools for black students, they tended to be separate than those for white students, extremely poorly funded. And you know, in the end, black students just had so many fewer opportunities. In my state of Delaware, for example, until 1950, there was only a single high school, comprehensive high school in the entire state that black students, a public high school that black students could go to. Only a single one. So students had to literally commute hours a day. And I know it's a small state, but yeah, it's quite a commute. So the disparity in opportunities for learning and advancement in a career through learning were just enormous. And what scholars have shown is that that created a template and a series of practices that in much more subtle ways stays with us today. From how we view students to what kinds of subjects that we teach and how we teach them to how students are evaluated, where we direct resources, we can still see massive inequality in things like the quality of schools that students tend to go to. So in so many districts, in equity of funding. And so on. So there's still a great deal of inequality that stems from the past.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Aaron Kupchak, who is the author of Suspended Education, School Punishment, and the Legacy of Racial Injustice. Aaron, you had mentioned the story of an administrator who grew defensive when you were speaking about structural racism in schools and your research into why black students are suspended more frequently than their white counterparts. How do you speak with school staff members, parents, about these ideas without them or with hopes of them not becoming defensive?
You know, I think it's important to have an open dialogue, which means not just them listening to me, but of course me listening to them. And what I've learned is that the concerns that parents and educators and school administrators' voice are very real, and I think that sometimes people, academics and policymakers, sometimes don't listen well enough. And so I try not to make that mistake. I try to listen to the concerns that people have. Part of the one of the many concerns that is defensiveness is not wanting to feel like they've done something bad or not wanting to feel like a bad person. And I think that educators should be prized. I think educators should be rewarded, respected, and valued. And my main mission here, equipped with better policies and practices that help them do their jobs. So distancing bad things that we do from from being bad people as teachers, I think is a first important step. A second is, again, taking into account the practical problems that they face. If I talk to a group of teachers and they walk away thinking, well, he wants to not hold students accountable or he doesn't care if there's disruption in my classroom, then I've really failed in that discussion because neither of those is true and I wouldn't want to communicate that. It's important that we hold students accountable for misbehavior, but that we do it in better ways, right? Not ways that harm them by bringing them further behind, but ways that can push them forward and help support them become better, more fully functioning human beings and better students and so on. But only once we listen to the real problems that teachers face, you know, that one disruptive student out of 35, for example, might be it. And what could we do differently? How could we better or give that teacher better options? So I think an important part is being clear, I mean, especially given all of the misunderstanding about any discussion of race, being clear of what it is that we're saying and what we're not trying to say, such as not blaming individuals, as well as listening and trying to deal with the problems that people face on the ground.
What are some of the alternatives to kicking someone out of school for a few days?
There are a lot of evidence-based strategies that a lot of schools are starting to use more frequently. They include things like restorative practices or positive behavioral interventions and supports or teaching social-emotional learning. And they all share a few key things. They really feature two things that I want to talk about. One is they help make school climates more inclusive. This means that schools feel more like a place where students are valued and respected and listened to and part of a community, and less like problems to be managed. We know from study after study that more inclusive school climates result in less student misbehavior and less even criminal behavior. A second element of these different strategies is that we meet students where they are, and instead of just punishing them, we hold them accountable, but in ways that help them solve problems. This could mean something as simple as sitting down with between a counselor and a student and talking about why the student misbehaved, or engaging in mediation between two students who have conflict with one another. But actually getting to the root of the problem and trying to address it. So it involves caring for students as children we care about rather than problems to be managed. Each of these strategies, ironically, there's evidence that they were in place before we moved away from them in the 60s and 70s as schools were desegregating and we moved more towards a focus on kicking kids out of school via suspension.
And Aaron, I just want to add that in your research, you cite a lot of Federal Education Department data from their Office of Civil Rights. And as you and I are talking, there's a conversation in Washington about closing the Department of Education. Where is your mind at right now in this sort of climate in Washington? And I know that this book just came out, but it seems like the ideas and the conversation is changing so fast from day to day.
Yeah, you're saying that right. Every day, it seems like there is definitely something new to think about and respond to. I think it would be a real shame if the Department of Education were closed, and I don't know the details of how they work well enough to say how efficient or inefficient the department is as it exists, but I do know that they provide a very valuable function. As I've been reading about in the news, a lot of folks have been talking about the function of funding that they provide, particularly funding towards equity for students who have additional needs. From my perspective, another enormous loss would be the massive research component that they help with. The Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights undertakes this enormously helpful data collection effort every 2 years that, you're right, informed a lot of the research that I did in this book and that I do in other projects as well. It would really be a loss for the ability of researchers all over who do all sorts of work in how we can help students learn best practices for education, including discipline, but also academics. It would really impair our ability to help schools do better.
So where will your research take you next?
Well, that's a great question. Can't I recover from this one first? I'm still interested in and conducting research on all sorts of issues having to do with school punishment. There's still so much that we don't know. For example, I'm interested, among other things, in how a lot of school departments or school districts, after 2020, after George Floyd's murder, how a lot of school districts removed police officers and then brought them back in some places. And I'm curious about the debates and why districts removed them, why they brought them back, how they're assessing the evidence that is out there, how that relates to the concerns of decision makers.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Aaron Kupchick is a professor of sociology and criminal justice at the University of Delaware and author of Suspended Education, School Punishment and the Legacy of Racial Injustice, published by New York University Press. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Springfield, Massachusetts was home to a battle of the bots recently. Western New England University hosted well over 1,000 volunteers, parents, and kids devoted to robotics, all for a tournament geared toward getting a new generation of learners involved in STEM. WAMC's Pioneer Valley Bureau Chief James Polyalagopoulos reports.
For 2 days, the basketball court at WNE was packed, but not for March Madness. High schoolers, coaches, and volunteers were taking part in the first robotics games hosted by the university, part of an international program that looks to combine the excitement of sport with the rigors of science and technology, it says. With the stands filled and nearly 40 teams fielding speedy metal robots the size of computer chairs in a small arena, the competition was fierce. Sophia Carrier, a senior at nearby Enfield High School, says the contest involves two alliances of three separate teams each, completing tasks like picking up PVC pipe and putting it on a rack for points. All the while, the opposition can send in a bot to block their efforts. There's also a time limit and a bit of a climb at the end.
At the end, there's an end game. The things in the middle are called the cages, and in order to, at the end, score on them, you have to actually climb on them. So the shallow cage is worth 6 points, the deep ones are worth 12.
The organization behind the contests, FIRST, for inspiration and recognition of science and technology, has been putting together events and leagues like these for decades in different age groups, fostering interest in robotics and STEM in general. For younger kids, that can mean building up bots and machines with Legos. For high schoolers like Leo Cush and his team from Interlakes High School in Meredith, New Hampshire, they get to work with the metal stuff.
The new competition gets released on like January 6th, and then we have from then until now, this is our first competition to build, program, and do everything for the robot. You can't have anything made before the competition is released, so we did it all in that time frame.
He and his team spoke with WAMC as they worked on their bot a few feet from the arena, testing hydraulics in the plastic catch meant to hold PVC pipes and balance them to their destination. The bots are expected to push, pull, speed, and grab, among other challenges, culminating in all kinds of excitement, says fellow LakerBots member Katie Strickland.
This is the best part, seeing everybody make the friends. I've made so many friends here, so has all of our team, and it's a really cool experience, along with the robots. The robots are also cool.
For context, the cheering and chanting was virtually nonstop during the elimination rounds WAMC sat in for. The whole event had a nautical theme. The game the robots played is known as Reefscape. Large dodgeballs that can be lifted into an enclosure for points are algae. The PVC pipes are coral that can be placed on metal bars known as reefs. And the metal cage bots have to grab at the very end are the barges. Spectators dressed appropriately. One group brought massive jellyfish puppets, while another, supporters for the long medals, opted for swashbuckling, with pirate gear and a ship mast standing over them. Lee Allentuck helped organize the first team from Longmeadow, Massachusetts.
Yeah, I started the team 13 years ago with my son when he was in fourth grade. And then as we kind of matriculated to high school, there was no high school program. So we wanted to put this together, and it's been great. We've impacted hundreds of kids, helped them find their thing, whether it's, you know, robotics, whether it's CAD drawing, whether it's coding, fundraising, business, marketing. Helps them find their thing that they love and helps them hopefully get into college and find their careers.
There were plenty of other local teams as well. That included the Discovery Polybots, the only Springfield team in the mix, with students from Discovery High School. Senior Eric Montiel says their hopes weren't exactly high, yet the event's top two teams, tasked with picking another to fill out their three-team alliance, picked them for the playoff matches. It became a Cinderella run for them after that, playing out as fellow senior Isabella Martinez spoke with WAMC.
Not even the fastest robot here. There's plenty of robots who have, like, their code and all types of things.
Yeah!
Following a review post-match, the Polybots found out their alliance earned the new high score of the event so far. The same alliance, including teams from Southington and Windsor Locks, Connecticut, would go on to be the event's winners. To Christian Salmon, Chair of Industrial Engineering and Engineering Management at WNE and Program Coordinator for the Western New England FIRST Robotics Initiative, showing kids the value of teamwork, coordinating, and more are just some of the competition's benefits.
For them, coming out and having an engineering mindset, a business mindset, the capacity to write code, and design and build, because it's one of the big things that everybody says kids can't do anything. They can't make things anymore. Well, look at these robots. They're fantastic things. So it's just life skills, including teamwork and working as a team, which is what everybody does in industry. You know, very few people work alone. They work as integrated team of people with different skill sets.
Salmon says the Western New England First Robotics event is a qualifier like others held in the region, and that top teams will go on to the district championships hosted at the Big E Fairgrounds in West Springfield in April. Reporting from Springfield, this is James Polyoligopoulos at WAMC's Pioneer Valley News Bureau on the campus of Western New England University.
If you'd like to tell the best of our knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to the best of our knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit WAMCpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1799. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Madeline Reynolds, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.